We're talking today with Robert Jensen, author of Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity. Robert, thanks for being with us today.
Great to be with you, Tom.
In reviewing the book, it seems as timely, if not even more so now. You wrote it in 2004, I believe, and talk a lot about not only post 9/11 politics in the United States, but also post February 15th, 2003, that being the day when so many people around the world got out in the streets and protested the impending invasion of Iraq. Could you maybe just first give a brief synopsis of what the book's about and why you felt compelled to write this book?
Yeah, I think it's important to think through this question of empire. Prior to 9/11, if you made the argument that the United States was an empire, you were usually labeled part of the loony left and laughed out of the room. But post 9/11, we've had an interesting shift in which even people on the right, even people in the centers of power, acknowledge that the United States is in fact an empire different in some senses than perhaps the British Empire or the Roman Empire, but an empire in the sense of having a worldwide reach through both military and economic power, and also empire in its most fundamental sense, which is the capacity to control the political sovereignty of other nations. And the United States has that capacity, and it exercises it frequently in order to concentrate its own wealth and power. That's an empire, and it's, I think, very important that we have finally, at least many of us in the U.S., have come to terms with the notion that the U.S. is an empire. The idea at the core of the book is that we are different in another sense, however, and that is we have not subjects. The British Empire, for instance, had subjects. The Roman Empire did not have a free and fully democratic system. But in the United States today, at least in legal terms, we are a democracy, and we are citizens of an empire. And I think the challenge, as I would put it in its most concentrated form, to the people of the United States today, is can we be something unique in history? Can we be the first citizens of an empire who, through internal political activity, end the empire? And I don't mean end the United States. I don't mean destroy the country. I mean shift the United States from an imperial stance to a stance of being not the nation on top of the world, but one of many nations in the world. And that's really what is the idea at the core of the book. How do we do that? How do we come to terms with the reality of our own history and our own place in the world today? And how do we move forward from that?
Well, it brings me to the subtitle of the book, the full title being Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity. And I agree with you that nowadays it seems widely acknowledged that the United States is an empire. But it's interesting to read the second part of the title, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity. Can you talk a little bit about what you mean by that?
Yeah, that's perhaps more controversial, because the argument I'm making, and is implicit in that subtitle, is that when you live in the empire, you cannot fully claim your humanity. That is, if you're affluent, as it is in the United States, I think, if your affluence is based in part on the subjugation of people elsewhere, if we all know that in some way we are a rich and prosperous country because other people suffer historically and in the contemporary period, then we know that we don't really have access to our full humanity. We're not part of the world. We're disconnected from the world in that sense. And it's important that in the subtitle I call it The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity, not to reclaim our humanity, because I want to also emphasize not only the sort of imperial nature of the U.S. today, but acknowledge that historically we are in this position of wealth and power because of a series of quite barbaric acts that created the United States. So I think that if we want to truly claim that humanity, we both have to come to terms with our history and the contemporary period. And then, of course, that leaves us with a challenge. Can we organize politically to try and change the nature of this government and this system? And I think I say system meaning not just the public face of it in terms of our government, but also the economic system in which we live. I'm one of those people who still thinks it's important to critique capitalism, to talk about why, in fact, capitalism and democracy are fundamentally incompatible from my point of view, and why this system of capitalism is a threat not only to equality around the world and democracy, but also a threat, quite literally, to the continuing sustainability of the planet, the ecological question. All of these things, I think, are right in front of us. They are pressing and compelling questions, and in a country that offers a lot of ways to avoid those issues, a lot of what I like to refer to as the cheap toys of empire, television, cheap food, easy entertainment, lots of ways to disconnect from the world. I think our challenge is to reconnect with the world and face up to these issues.
Throughout the book, you do, in developing your argument, you do a considerable amount of looking at some terminology and defining those things and defining the differences between certain words, such as hope as opposed to optimism, being critical as opposed to being cynical, nationalism as opposed to patriotism. Can you just talk about some of those words and the differences between them for a minute?
Sure. In the bigger picture, when one faces political crises, when one sees the world in trouble and wants to act, I think we often want to say it's time to act, not to sit around and theorize, not to think. But this is actually a moment in which I think it's very important to theorize, and I don't mean that in a kind of academic and elitist sense, but in trying to understand how the world works. And sometimes that means trying to understand how language works and trying to look at ways in which language is used to keep us trapped. So, for instance, there's a chapter on the question of the support the troops rhetoric. We all want to be nice people. We all want to support our fellow countrymen and women, and so we want to, we often have a reaction where we want to support the troops, but I try to talk about how the whole support the troops rhetoric is designed to keep people away from political engagement, and we can't sort of fall into that trap. As you point out, I try and distinguish between what might seem like similar concepts but can be quite different. For instance, I talk about the difference between hope and optimism, which is a distinction many people have written about over the years. I talk about the fact that I'm not optimistic in the short term, but I have hope in the long term. That is, I look at the world, I see the way in which right-wing forces have really become extremely powerful in this country, and I'm not optimistic that I'm going to wake up tomorrow and see, a progressive revolution in the U.S. It doesn't mean I don't have hope that that can't be achieved, but I think we have to distinguish between our rational assessments of what is possible in the short term, because if we don't do that, then we often develop very unrealistic expectations. And I think we have to distinguish between those things and a longer period question, a longer term question of how to have hope, how to understand that people are capable of very creative action, and that we look back at history and see that even when short-term attempts to bring progressive change failed, those people who kept at it over time, who had hope for the long term, were often very successful. And here I think it's incredibly important for people in the U.S. to think a lot about history, because this is a very short-term, immediate gratification kind of society. And that's true not only of the mainstream culture, but that does affect the left and the progressive movements as well. And there have been many points in history when immediate short-term change just wasn't possible, and people had to dig in for the long term. Certainly that's the story of the labor movement. It's the story of the civil rights movement. It's the story, in fact, of every movement that has tried to challenge concentrated power. And I think we have to, pay attention to that so we don't develop unreasonable expectations and then be extremely, depressed and passive and paralyzed when those short-term expectations aren't met.
So now, getting back to putting the timing of coming out with your book, Citizens mm-hmm. of the Empire, to a post 9/11 and also post February 15th, 2003 world. Now here we are, post 2004 election, something that caused a fair amount of progressives and liberals a certain level of depression and frustration.
Yeah.
Just recently, the Senate snuck through a provision that opens up the coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling. Every day we're hearing about deaths in Iraq and elsewhere. Where do people who want to somehow affect change find hope?
Well, here I might be a little unusual, because while I was not happy about the election of George Bush in 2004, I must say that I woke up that day without that sense of depression or angst that many people in the left progressive community had. And that's because I didn't have very high expectations. I thought the Democrats ran the worst possible campaign. I felt they had virtually no possibility of winning once the Kerry campaign made a strategic decision to abandon the anti-war movement and to really turn away from the one source of strength and energy that could have propelled the Democrats forward. Now, this was not surprising to me, in part because I have so few expectations from the Democratic Party in its current form. So I woke up, the day after the election, basically feeling the same way I did the day before, which is that there's a lot of work to build grassroots institutions in the United States that can carry forward left progressive political work. I happen to work in one in Austin, Texas, that we started about a year and a half, 2 years ago. And we have a goal. Our goal is to continue to work on issues in the short term, to organize people and educate people about the war in Iraq and about U.S. corporate globalization and those sorts of things. But also, our goal is to be around in 5 years and in 10 years. That is one of the things that typically we have not done very well on the left progressive side in recent decades, is build long-lasting institutions where people can know that down the road there will be the same folks there working on the same issues and sticking with it. And so I woke up the morning after the election and had the same work in front of me that I had the day before. And quite frankly, if John Kerry had been elected, I don't think that work would have changed. I think that the Democratic Party represents a different set of interests in the elite culture, but still represents interests from the elite culture. And my goal is to be part of the process by which we build a grassroots movement that represents ordinary people, not those elite interests.
In the latter part of your book, speaking of institutions, you talk about the educational system, particularly the college educational system, and, of course, the media. How can people who want to bring about change affect those and work with those institutions? It seems as though, in both cases, to a great extent, there's been a sort of massive scale of takeover or a sort of buyout, privatization, if you want to call it that, of those institutions, and their particularly mainstream media just seems so conservative nowadays. How can individuals affect change there?
Well, I think those are two very important institutions to think about, education and the news media. Now, it just so happens that I've spent my entire adult life as either a journalist or a teacher, so these are the two main ways in which we socialize people in this culture, and they are therefore incredibly important. How do we affect change? Well, it's a different question for each institution. On higher education, for instance, there is, as you point out, a move toward privatizing, toward reducing public funding and forcing universities into the private sector. And, of course, when you do that, those institutions will increasingly reflect the interests of the private sector. And we need to support public education, public support for higher education. Of course, there's also a very real threat today to academic freedom, to the right of university professors to pursue critical inquiry. We see that, for instance, most clearly in the attack on Ward Churchill at the University of Colorado. And so tenure and academic freedom, which may seem like rather arcane issues to people outside the university, are in fact very important to the intellectual and political health of the country, I think. So there are places where people can move on those two issues. In the media, I think it's a very complex but very important strategic question. How do you try to create a more democratic media system? Well, the first thing, as you point out, we have to observe is that the U.S. media system, kind of unique in the industrial world, is almost completely commercial. There's no meaningful public broadcasting system in the U.S., for instance. So one question is, how do we try to create political support for public broadcasting that would be truly independent both of corporate interests and of government interests. There are ways in which I think we can try to support those within journalism who really do have the ideals that, that have always motivated the best journalists. That is, the ideals of, you know, to use the old phrase, comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable. Well, there are journalists working in the system who would very much like to be able to pursue those kinds of goals, and a public movement can support them. I think things like strengthening the union for journalists, a very weak unionized industry, for instance, would be helpful. And then, of course, there's alternative media. And it's important to recognize that alternative media are important not only for the unfiltered news that you can get, that is, news not filtered by the corporate media, at least. They're important to us in the way they deliver information to us. But they're also important in the way that they push the mainstream media. There are many examples when stories that break in the alternative news media can affect how the corporate commercial news media work. And so there are all of those things, you know, trying to create a better structure for public broadcasting, trying to support journalists in their willingness to do good work, and of course supporting and using alternative media. All of this is part of a media strategy, I think, that can be quite exciting. And there's work going forward on that. I know and many people are probably familiar with a group called the Free Press, which is organizing around questions of regulation of broadcasting, for instance, trying to put the public into that issue more directly. There's a conference in St. Louis in mid-May that will take up some of those issues. So there's a lot of places where people can today go lend their efforts.
Can you give us an example of a story that broke in alternative media that went on to affect mainstream media somehow?
Sure. The successes here are sometimes few and far between. I don't want to over-dramatize it, but take a story people might be familiar with. In the 1980s, in 83, 84, folks may remember that Donald Rumsfeld was appointed a special envoy by the Reagan administration to go to Iraq and try and smooth things over with the government of Saddam Hussein. So this monster that we are told about so often, who in fact was truly monstrous, was in fact a U.S. ally through much of the 1980s. And there was actual footage, video of Donald Rumsfeld meeting with Saddam Hussein. Some may be familiar with the famous still photograph taken from that of Rumsfeld shaking hands with Saddam Hussein. Well, that story was broken. The fact that that meeting happened and the consequences and conditions under which that meeting went forward, that was broken by an independent journalist, a man who was a producer for Democracy Now and also an independent journalist. And it made its way onto the web, and eventually the mainstream media, the New York Times, the Washington Post, those kinds of places, did have to run stories acknowledging this. Now, it was important not just because it kind of pointed out that Donald Rumsfeld was a hypocrite, which is hardly news in that sense, but it pointed out the bigger story, which is that the United States had been supporting Saddam Hussein through some of the worst of his atrocities in the 1980s, and that U.S. interests were not around democracy and freedom. U.S. interests in the region were around control and domination. So that's one example of how that kind of work by independent journalists can affect the mainstream. And I think to the degree we help fund, and it's very important to stress, independent media needs financial support. They can't do what they do, you know, on a wing and a prayer. But the degree to which we fund and support that kind of journalism, it will have increasingly effects, I think, on the mainstream.
You talked a few moments ago about the difference between hope and optimism. Another difference that you point out, or a couple of terms that you talk about in Citizens of the Empire, it's the difference between being critical and being cynical.
Right.
And of course, many, many people, I've experienced it, and I know a lot of people who are listening, who you know, take a progressive stance on politics and who are progressives at heart, get into discussions with people and are accused of being cynical when they're just being critical. But could you kind of describe the difference and why that's important to distinguish that?
Yes, I think it's a crucial difference. I spent much of my life being cynical. And I was a journalist, and journalists tend to be cynics in general. And I thought, you know, that being cynical made me smarter than everybody else. And it was only sort of later in life, after I started to become more politically active, that I realized that cynicism is actually a very self-indulgent and, frankly, quite juvenile reaction to the world. Yes, the world has problems. Yes, people seem to routinely behave in ways that are often impossible to fathom. Yes, there is suffering that sometimes, you know, is beyond description. All of that's true. It's also true that the world is full of solidarity and compassion and people who rise above their own self-interest to do quite extraordinary things. And a cynic looks at only the negative and then, I think, in sort of self-congratulatory ways, comes to the conclusion that nothing is possible and then retreats. I think someone who is critical but engaged looks at the world in all its complexity, looks at the good and the bad, and asks, how do we move forward to try and make the world a better place? Now, for a lot of people, to express that, I think they're afraid of being called naive or idealistic. Maybe it's an odd world we live in which the word idealistic is now an insult. I hear students actually say that. Someone will express a very clear and passionate argument for justice, let's say, and other students will say, well, you're just being idealistic. Well, sure, and isn't that a good thing? You know, I mean, shouldn't we encourage that? Shouldn't we, you know, help people articulate the best ideals of being human? So, you know, it's understandable why people want to retreat, because the world is, in very many ways, an ugly place. But the world is also, in very many ways, a beautiful place. And cynicism, I think, keeps us from recognizing the world in all its beauty and complexity, but also keeps us from acting. And that's really why people in power don't mind a cynical world. I think the folks who run this country would be very happy to see everybody sort of collapse into cynicism, because cynical people don't take political action. And critical people, people who are engaged, can take political action. So I think that distinction is incredibly important.
And one other distinction in terminology that you make that I think is absolutely crucial as a citizen of the United States in 2005 is the difference between nationalism and patriotism. Can you talk about that a bit?
Well, yes. And here I have a view that's somewhat different than many. I think we often talk about nationalism as a negative force, that kind of jingoistic, you know, my country right or wrong conception of nationalism. And I agree, that's extremely dangerous and extremely, I think, juvenile again. It's a very limited way to see the world. What people often say then, but patriotism, you know, love of country, a real love of country that includes the willingness to be critical and dissident, is somehow acceptable. And in that chapter, I try to point out that, from my point of view, patriotism and nationalism are essentially always the same thing. I'm not only against that kind of jingoistic nationalism, that very chauvinistic nationalism. I'm, quite frankly, at this point, arguing against any conception of patriotism for a very simple reason, is that our allegiances, I argue in that chapter, shouldn't be to a nation. A nation is an arbitrary political unit. I think our allegiances in the world should be toward principles and ideals that we can universalize, that is, let's say, the concept of real freedom or real democracy, which I think we should want to make universal. I think we should have a commitment to those ideals, and we should have a commitment to a collective humanity. That is, I think we have to get past the point where we think there's anything special about being in this country, or that there's any special connection we have to people in this country. I try to think of my obligations and connections to the world, not to a nation. So, in a sense, what I'm arguing is that I think patriotism is a kind of an artifact of history that we're going to have to get beyond. We've seen the destructive capacity of nation states. And I realize it's quite an undertaking to say, let's start thinking beyond the nation state, since our whole world, of course, is organized around the idea of states. We are citizens of a country. And I think that's one of the things that over the long term we're going to have to challenge. Much in the same way, I would argue, we're going to have to think about how to challenge over the long-term capitalism. Because from my point of view, the world cannot survive nation-states and capitalism for much longer. These are, I think, inherently systems that concentrate wealth and power, and I don't think we can continue on that path indefinitely. So while we're working on short-term issues, let's try to stop the war. In fact, let's try to build a country in which war is not a policy option. All of those things are important, but it's also important to think creatively about the long term, about what kind of political organizations, what kind of economic organizations are really sustainable over the long term. I think those questions are important. I realize they can seem abstract, and in some sense it's easy to want to push those aside toward the more important and pressing issues, but I do think we have to always keep talking about them. I think one of the important political questions we have to face in this country is often not seen as political, and that's the level at which we live in the U.S. That is the incredible affluence of this country. I think it's fair to say, the most affluent country in the history of the world. And even those of us who live perhaps, you know, not at the elite level, we're not all Donald Trump, but most people in the United States live at a level of comfort that is really unknown in much of the world. Half the world's population lives on less than $2 a day. The striking figure that I think always need to keep in the forefront of our imaginations as we try to work politically. I think this leads to a conclusion that is often very difficult for people, which is, if we are going to really create a just and sustainable world, that is, if we are going to transform this world, it means, from my point of view, that the living standards of people in the United States are going to have to change, and that means change downward. That is, we are going to have to start consuming less. We cannot live at this level of affluence indefinitely if we want to bring both justice and sustainability to the world. Now, I don't think that means that it's our obligation to wake up today and sell everything we own and become impoverished, because that's not going to do anything to bring justice to the world. But we do have to start thinking about how are we going to step back from a high-energy, high-consumption lifestyle, because this lifestyle is not only not generalizable to the rest of the world. That is to say, if the rest of the world lived like we do, there would be simply no way the planet could continue. It's also not sustainable even if it's contained to the first world. That is, if the first world continues on this path, it's, from my point of view, highly unlikely that we're going to make it into the next century. Those are serious questions. I don't think there are simple answers to them, and I certainly don't think I'm in a position to dictate to people how they should live. But I do think this fundamental question of how can we scale back the way in which we live to a more just, that is, a level that we can try to bring to the rest of the world, and a more sustainable, that is, one that can truly be sustained over the long term, is at the heart of any progressive politics in the world today.
Okay, Robert Jensen, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Tom. Great conversation and important subject.